Welcome to Lessons from a PhD, where every single episode teaches you different lessons to make your PhD and career journey easier. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Lessons from a PhD. My name is Dr. Anna A.O., and I am your host. And today, I have a very special guest with me to share about her journey and her experience through PhD, post-PhD, life, motherhood, and everything in between. I have Dr. Vera Onana Adebona. So, Dr. Vera, thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you, Anna. Thank you for having me.
So before we start, I do want to give a brief bio of you to our audience because you have done so much in the space of your career and also in the nonprofit space as well. So Dr. Vera is a scientist and consultant at Environmental Resources Management, specializing in aquatic microbial ecology and genomics. She holds a PhD in biology from Concordia University, Montreal, and contributed to a major freshwater research initiative, the Pan-Canadian Lake Study, where she investigated microbial communities in over 600 lakes across 12 Canadian ecozones. Her work helped develop one of Canada's most comprehensive metagenomic lake databases through the NSERC-funded Canadian Lake Pulse Network. Passionate about community and inclusion, Vera is the founder of She Thrives PhD, a woman-centric support community that empowers international doctoral candidates. She is also a science communicator, former journalist, kids event planner, and a strong advocate for greater representation of Black women in STEM. So thank you again, Dr. Vera, and we're so excited to hear about your journey. So let's just dive in to this conversation. Yeah. So I know that I've heard maybe a little bit about you when we first met. Actually, before that, let's tell the audience how we met, because I always like to share with the audience, you know, how I met my guests, because I think it really shows just how you can meet people from different avenues of life. So maybe if you want to share how we first met, I'll push it over to you.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I could talk about that a little bit. So I'm not sure, because when I first wrote you on LinkedIn, we had met before virtually at the Canadian Black Scientist Network. I was I signed up at the time. I was volunteering, and you were also there. And they were trying to create some new subgroups at some point, and we kind of were paired up together. So yeah, so I was also like deep in the trenches of my PhD also at that time, and I was thinking, oh no, I should do something more. I should do something more. You know, that kind of like push you get when you're in your PhD, thinking, yeah, I should get a life outside this lab. But then you try to get outside the lab, and then you find out, oh no, I'm taking on too much.
Yeah, then you overwork yourself, you get stressed out. Yes,
exactly. So I signed up for CBSN. I'm like, yeah, this is the thing. I'm going to like join the community, be an executive, and I'm just going to do all the fun stuff. And I didn't last after one meeting. I'm like, whoa, this is a lot. But you were in that meeting, and I noted your name, and we kind of like did a round table thingy. You were in that meeting, and I think this was sometime around 2022, and all of that time passed. Yeah, and I defended my PhD last year, and right before my defense, I decided that yeah, this time I'm going to start something and I'll see through to completion. This is something I'd always wanted to do. So I founded STP at the same time. And I started to think about, oh, you know, phenomenal people that I could talk to help to spread this word out, people that are interested in doing things like this. And then I was in a meeting and somehow your name came up because you'd been interviewed by a particular group. And I was talking to someone who worked for the organization. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I kind of sort of know her. We were in CBSN together at some point, you know, so I grabbed my phone and then I wrote you this lengthy message on LinkedIn and crickets.
I'm so sorry. Listen, I was on maternity leave going through the trenches of motherhood. Oh, okay.
I know. So I was like, you know what? Yeah. Yeah. I'll just let it go. But then I found the podcast and I listened to that episode where you talked about being a new mom. And I said, oh, yeah, I totally get it. Okay, mm-hmm. I'm going to write her another email just because she's a new mom. And if she doesn't respond to this one,
Yeah, first of all, you have great memory because I even forgot about the whole CBSN interaction. So I'm glad that you brought that up. And I have mentioned, I think on a previous episode, about the Canadian Black Scientist Network and how it's a really good network for any Canadians that are scientists or doing their PhD or even mm-hmm. out of school working in the science field or even STEM field in general. So mm-hmm. I would really recommend any Canadians out there that are listening to this podcast to plug into CBSN because you can meet wonderful people, you can build community, and there's a lot of opportunities to volunteer as well. So you did mention about STP, which is She Thrives PhD, which is an initiative that you started. But mm-hmm. before we dive into that, I kind of want to go back in time to even before your PhD and kind of share, you know, how did you get interested in science? Because I always find it very interesting how some people, they may say that, you know, from a very ripe age when they were born, they were playing with chemicals.
That's not my story.
Exactly. Yes. And I know that not everyone's like that. So I would love to hear how you got interested into science and even specifically your field. Right, which is microbial ecology. So if you want to share about that.
Yeah, at 11, honestly, I didn't care about what my career path was going to be. All I cared about was I was done wearing, you know, the dress for junior secondary school. I wanted to transition into wearing skirts for senior secondary school. I stayed in the science class mostly because I was doing well at it, not because I felt like some sort of deep connection to it, at least not at the beginning. So if we circle back a little bit, what I wanted to be from the start was a journalist. And that's because I grew up watching the NTA news with my parents, and there was this woman in the late night news. I loved her so much. I totally wanted to be this woman. And yeah, I did get to pursue that dream years later. I got a chance to explore that dream. I applied for a job in journalism. I came out on top. I was doing really well at it. But I think, not that I think, it was in doing that that the reality hit me, that my edge at being so good with journalism and being so great at it was actually the strong science background that I had. Being in the sciences, doing the biology, you know, all of that sharpened my ability to think critically, to communicate clearly, and I was able to tell stories grounded in facts. So after like years in doing what I thought I always was meant to do, I realized that my heart still belonged to science. So I made that decision to let journalism go and return to that path that had chosen me from the beginning. I didn't choose it from the beginning. You know, in the beginning, there was a village. There were people who saw something in me much longer before I did and thought that, yeah, you would thrive in this. And they tried to like encourage me to pursue that path in science. So when it all came together, it was like a 360. And I realized that, okay, since these people knew exactly what they were talking about at the beginning. So I decided to go back. And looking back right now, science wasn't a detour. It was actually the foundation that has supported every part of my journey up until now.
That's very interesting, especially from your shift from journalism to science, because many people may think that you went from one country to the other, like it was such a huge shift. But like you said, the foundation is the same, because in journalism, you research. Right, you're researching something different. In science, you also research, and you're just mm-hmm. researching something different. So I think it's very interesting how research brought your two loves together of journalism and science.
And science, yeah. And it was totally something I could like do together, because, you know, being a journalist at the time, I wanted to do some feature stories, like personal angle stories, but somehow my editors kept sending me to go cover science because, oh, you have the background. So I kind of was still doing science in journalism as well.
Yeah. And I mean, so, like, not to say
I went from science to journalism, then back.
Yes. And not to say that, you know, your journalism went to waste, because you still are active in science communication as well. That's still a passion of yours, right?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So in what ways do you kind of use that from, I guess, in a day-to-day basis or even in your career when it comes to science communication?
Oh, science communication is something that's been, it's been integral in my career up until now. At some point, well, during my PhD, I was volunteering with the with STEM Canada, and I was like consulting on science communication. So basically what we were doing at the time was grooming high school students, undergraduates in the university, how to go about oral presentations for conferences, you know, how to make their posters. And I did that for a while until towards the end of my PhD, when things got really intense and I just had to step away from that for a little bit. Mm-hmm. But there is that. And also in PhD, there's every time you need to be able to articulate what you're doing.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Not just to your professor and not just to your lab mates, to people in conferences. For me, I went door to door knocking during my research because we needed to access lakes. And some of these lakes were in rural areas behind people's homes. So you need to come up to their front door and say, oh, hi. You need to tell them what you're doing. And you can't go about using all that scientific jargon. You need to tell them what they would understand as everyday people. Mm-hmm. And then they give you access to their lakes, you know. And most of the time we're getting questions like, oh, is this going to influence the fish we can get from the lake? Is this going to change, you know? Well, I'm not quite a fish person. It was kind of difficult to explain that part of the research. But yes, that science communication all through the way. And then there comes the conferences and all of that. You need to get in their defense. You just keep using it, keeps showing up. And I'm blessed to have been able to go through that, you know, from the beginning, and then also doing journalism for a while and then coming back to do science. So every time I have an oral presentation, people in my lab are always waiting for my intro because they're like, oh, she's always coming with these fun intros. I want to hear what she's going to say this time. Because, you know, I try to just relate to everyone. I use a lot of analogies. I use a lot of stories, and that just kind of became my thing. Everyone wanted to hear my introductions, you know, and it was something I picked up from writing feature stories in journalism. So yeah, it all came back together, and it was a beautiful, really nice time. And who knows?
No, I absolutely love that, because I know, like, and I can say flat out that I'm this way too. Scientists, we're so just to the point. And we're so direct, right? But these days, I'm really starting to understand how science is an art. And sometimes it can be expressed like an art as well.
Totally.
So I love how, you know, I would love to hear your intros, first of all. Please. I won't put you on the spot, but maybe offline. I would love to hear some fancy intros that you have come up with. Because I think it also makes it so beautiful and very, very relatable as well, like you said, for someone who doesn't know science, right? To kind of bring that art form to science, it makes it more digestible. So I love that, you know, you're specialized in that and you have experience in it. And I think that all scientists should also take that piece as well.
Oh, it took some fighting for. It took some fighting for, because people thought, oh, you're just too fancy with your words. Oh, just go to the science, you know, at the beginning. My supervisor and I used to be like, oh, do you have any fancy stuff to start with? Because it was just like, Vera wouldn't go straight to the point. So, yeah, it took some fighting for, and people warmed up to it. And it just kind of became my thing. And then then at some later, towards the end of my PhD, popular science just caught up, and it became, everybody wanted popularized science. Like, they wanted stuff that the everyday person could connect with. And so people were coming to me to say, oh, how can I make this? How can I dumb this down? And initially it was like, no, just go straight to the point. So, yeah, it took some fighting for, and I'm happy that I decided to just be me while I was a scientist at the same time.
That's a whole message. Like, if we end the podcast here, like, it would be great, because I think that's a whole message. Just be you, you know. And as you can tell from your story, just the short story that you shared, your difference became your strength. You know, you were an unconventional scientist, and everyone was like, oh, here comes Vera with her stories again. You know,
again.
But oh, when they realized that it was valuable, you know, then people come running to you because that's your strength. You're good at communicating science. So I think that's amazing. That's really great.
I did use Lord of the Rings once.
I would love to hear that, but I won't put you on the spot.
Please don't.
So you did say that you did your PhD here at Concordia University, which is in Montreal. But prior to that, you lived in Nigeria, correct?
Correct. Yeah, that's right.
So
all my life.
Yeah. So how was that transition? Because I can't even imagine, you know, growing up in a place, you have your establishment there, your family's there, and then you're moving to a completely different country where you don't know anyone to start one of the hardest things that you can ever do in this life, which is a PhD.
My entire life.
Your entire life.
Two suitcases.
Yes.
Of 23 kg each.
I can't even imagine. So first of all, let's talk about your transition and how did you manage with just settling in here, settling here in Canada, and then also taking a deep dive into your PhD.
Yeah, it was difficult. And up until now, I used to say it was the hardest thing I've had to do in my life, but not anymore. That changed recently. But
we'll
honestly,
talk about that
it felt
soon.
Like, yes, we will. We'll definitely get into that. Mm-hmm. But it felt like stepping completely into two different planets. There's no comparison. Right. Mm-hmm. Even back in Nigeria, you know, my master's research was tough, but it was a different kind of tough. Practicals were rare, and sometimes it just meant identifying or labeling lab equipment that we never actually got to use, because most of it was theoretical work. There wasn't so much practical stuff. I had to buy my own materials. That's a different kind of tough. From Petri dishes to agar. I even had to improvise with syringes because we didn't have pipette pumps lying around the labs here. We didn't have those. So forget using equipments like autoclaves as a student. No way. Those were like completely off limits. They were for the technicians. So if we had to sterilize stuff, you'd get in a queue and wait for the technicians to operate the autoclave. So that was a different kind of tough. And then I got to Montreal for my PhD, and I was blown away. Oh, you needed to see the lab. Stuff I'd only seen in textbooks. There were PCR machines, massive autoclaves, industrial centrifuges, and I was expected to use all this stuff myself after orientation. No, it was exciting. But then after the excitement came a lot of intimidation. That shift really opened my eyes to see the impact of how much investment in education and research, how much change or how much difference it can make. So it was a different kind of hard back home. And then coming here was a completely different kind of hard. But then I went through the orientations and somehow I started getting comfortable with sterilizing stuff by myself, you know, using the centrifuges, not thinking I would break something. And you can't really compare the differences. And this made me realize how there's so much untapped potential existing in a place like Nigeria back home. Imagine what we would do if we had all of this equipment right from the beginning and all these right tools and all the training. Imagine the difference that would have made. So yeah, it was two different worlds, two different toughs, two different kind of hearts.
No, I really love that you shed light on that, because I think that here in Canada, we don't understand how blessed we are when it comes to research and how much funding that the government actually puts into science research or STEM research, I'll just say in general, because places like Nigeria or even Ghana, which is my background, you know, like you don't only just have the toughness of maybe the course or the program that you're in, but you have the toughness of trying to manage research and come up with results with very limited equipment. You know, things that we take for granted here in a research lab, like pipettes or just random things that we take for granted, you know?
Pipette tips.
The ones that we break. You don't know how many times I broke pipette tips in my lab.
And then you just dump it in the bin.
Yeah, you throw it in the trash. Meanwhile,
you don't reuse them.
Yeah, there's people in Nigeria or even Ghana or any other place, you know, that it's hard to come by. So I really like that you shed light on that and just the challenges. And I can't even imagine, you know, going from one place and studying and then being all alone in a new country, you know.
Oh yeah, that's just one part of it. Yeah. So I'm going to go next into the culture shock.
Yeah, so I was going to ask that next too, actually. So
yeah.
How did handle the culture shock? And I from what I remember that you told me, you came in the thick of winter in January.
I did. I started in winter.
Well, how was that?
I had my gloves, I had a hat, I had hand warmers, I had everything I could literally put on, and I was still shivering. And then somewhere in my head, I'm thinking, oh goodness, is this going to be my life now? Why did I do this? Why am I always looking for the hard things? Why am I always pushing myself this far? You know, the culture shock was real, academically, socially, or even weather. Everything felt new. Everything felt overwhelming. Transit, everything felt overwhelming. Mm. But academically, I must say that it was a steep learning curve, because I was transitioning from being a general microbiologist. All I used to do back then was culture, isolate, identify microbes using traditional lab techniques. So easy peasy, I was great at it. But then I was entering a whole new world. Here, I'm doing the fancy stuff. Yeah, that's what I wanted, but I had no idea how much work I'd have to put in. The whole new world of genomics, of sequences, bioinformatics, coding, high-level multivariate statistical analysis. I even had to get familiar with machine learning.
Wow.
All in the space of the period of my PhD, because I had no knowledge of this like prior. It felt like I was learning all over again. It felt like I hadn't done science in my BSc, my master's. It was a completely different ballgame. Mm-hmm. There was that. I had times where I was in the lab up until 1 a.m. in the morning. Mm-hmm. My lab literally was my home. I had food stashed in the fridge. I had snacks. I had little pick-me-ups, cakes and stuff for when I just needed some sugar.
Yeah. You know,
I literally was living in the lab because that was the only way I felt that I could even get a grasp of what I was doing. I was learning everything from the scratch. So there was that. And then there was the lab culture itself. I don't know how it is in Ghana, but you know, back home in Nigeria, the student-supervisor relationship is very hierarchical, you know, almost like a boss-servant kind of dynamic. At my institution, you were expected to kneel to greet your supervisor as a female student back home. Yeah, not doing so could lead to some very serious consequences.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay, I'll stop there so people don't come for me. But then I got to Montreal and suddenly I saw undergrads addressing my supervisor by his first name.
Like first name.
And I couldn't do it.
Mm.
I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
6 years, 6 months in PhD, I called him prof from the first day till the very end. He just gave up. Like, Vera, come on. When are you going to stop? I just couldn't bring myself to do it. But, you know, I think what helped me adapt to all of that drastic change, you know, the academic change, the culture shock, the weather. Oh, I was sleeping right next to the heater for the first, like, 1 month.
Oh, no.
And I still could not get warm. Yeah, I couldn't get warm.
In Montreal, winters are cold, too.
I would take my blankets, I'll take everything off from the bed and just lie next to the heater.
Oh.
But I still couldn't get warm. And then I would break down. Like, what is this? It was brutal. It was brutal. You know, but I think what helped me adapt to all of these things was taking it one step at a time. I asked for help when I needed it. Mm. And my supervisor was really great at the beginning, you know, helping me. And suddenly, or rather slowly, I started building confidence in this new academic world. Eventually, I don't know when, but somehow I found my rhythm.
Mm.
Yeah. And we didn't have the fancy equipment in Nigeria. We didn't have the PCR machines, the massive autoclaves and all of that, but we had a culture of resilience.
Mm-hmm.
And I brought that with me
mm-hmm.
from Nigeria. I brought that with me. So, yeah, that kind of tenacity that you get from surviving in a place of lack, of inadequacy, you know, you become a scrappy little fighter. Mm-hmm. And I brought that with me. So when the winter hit hard, that resilience was there. That tenacity from Nigeria, it kept me going.
Mm.
And I would say it was pretty much how I survived it. And at some point, yeah, I was waiting for the winter to come. Because it's pretty much the longest it of is all the seasons, longest. Right? So,
right?
Yeah, we got used to it anyways.
That's insane. Like, hearing you speak about your experience, I'm like, you did two PhDs because
pretty much.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Because I can only imagine just like the culture shock, the culture shock, right?
Mm.
And then also the academic shock. And the one thing that you said that was very interesting is that you found your rhythm. And I think that's something that's so key, you know, and one thing that I always say is that everything is always hard until you learn. And going through a PhD and even just like life in general, you'll see that there's always these learning curves that you have to go over. And if you look at a curve, the shape, there's a hill going up. And then once you go over the curve, it's down.
You play two, you come right back down.
Exactly. Yeah. Now with a PhD, there are several learning curves. It's not just one. Maybe every single month you're hitting a learning curve and it's going to be
tough,
and you're going to need to be resilient. You're going to need to be tenacious. But once you get up over that curve, you find your rhythm and then you hit another curve. And then you go up, you find your rhythm, you know?
And then something else.
And then something else. But it's
just when you think you're getting a hang of it.
Yeah.
It doesn't end.
At the end of the day, you will always find your rhythm if you just keep at it. And I think that's the message right there, that you just stuck it through and you kept at it. And in the end, you found your rhythm.
Right.
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 So kudos to you, honestly. Like, I hear your story and I'm inspired. And I think that all the international students that come here for education, whether it be bachelor's, master's, PhD, whatever, you guys all deserve your flowers. Because
I did try to quit.
Yeah.
So I don't pay me at some kind of ear.
I don't even think like I would last because I've been here my whole life. I'm still not used to the winters. Canadian winters, I just can't handle. You will not see me go outside. I hibernate in the winters. So I can only imagine you coming from Nigeria where it's sunny and hot 24/7.
35, 33
coming
degrees.
To like minus 40 weather.
I did decide that I was going to quit my PhD more than once even.
Mm-hmm.
It felt like too much. It felt like too much at times. But honestly, I've come to believe that if you never get to that breaking point in a PhD where you think, yes, this is it, I'm done. Well, maybe you're doing it wrong because it's just that kind of journey. It stretches you. It stretches you. It stretches you. It keeps taking from you.
Yes.
And so I just didn't get to the finish line. it has to be noted that I did try to run away a number of times.
So you said that last year you graduated from your PhD, right? Mm-hmm. So congratulations.
Thank you.
And thank you. Shortly after, you became a mother as well. So congratulations again.
And thank you.
That's I'll one of the that things one. That we also connected over. I think our children are a few months apart, right? Because we both had babies last year. And if I understand correctly, you're still on maternity leave right now.
Still am.
You still are. So so let's talk about just the whole shift in going from academics. You're in your books, you're studying, you're working, to going to a completely different season of life, motherhood, because I know that I struggle and I'm still struggling with it. And if you listen, shameless plug, but if you listen to my previous episode or a few episodes ago that I started at the beginning of the year called New Year, New Role, where I talk about my transition into motherhood, you will understand kind of the challenges I faced. And I remember I said that motherhood was the toughest thing, most selfless thing I've ever had to do in my whole entire life. So I would love for you to share your experience about just your transition into this new season that you're in.
Yeah, at the beginning of this conversation, I did say that I thought my PhD was the hardest thing I'd ever have to do in my life. Because in the middle of my PhD, one of my lowest points came from after a three-year period of data generation, I found some artifacts. So I had to scrap everything and start all over again. And that was a massive breaking point for me, right? But somehow I got through all of that. And yeah, we got that PhD. So I was thinking, oh, I've always wanted to be a mom. I've always, Anna, I've always wanted to be a mom. Look, I had it all thought out in my head. Names, gender, number of kids. I'm like that person. I love babies. You know, your classic baby whisperer. Because somewhere in my head, I'm like, I'm just going to thrive so well in being a mother. I'm organized. I'm detailed. Oh, I went through a PhD. What's a baby? Oh, scrap all of that. I hope I never said that. Because matricence, what a journey.
It's unreal.
Oh my goodness.
Absolutely unreal.
What a journey. Now, don't get me wrong. It's like the most unraveling, beautiful experience. One that can only really be lived to understood. You need to like live it, experience it to understand it. But you can't fully explain how much it transforms you. I've changed a lot since being a mom. Mm-hmm. And as much as I thought I had prepared, I was completely unprepared. Mm-hmm. I have felt inexplicable joy and I have cried at the same time. Mm-hmm. I have cried over losing parts of myself. Mm-hmm. I have cried over craving rest, but then I'm still struggling to take a break because I know I need to take a break, but I just can't stop. Yeah. And it hits harder when you're someone like me. You know, I said, I'm detailed, I'm organized, almost the perfectionist, structured. Babies don't follow blueprints. We're almost 9 months postpartum, and I'm still trying to get my son on the schedule. Oh.
You're living my life. Honestly, you're literally living
Ask
my life.
Ask me how that's working out for me. No, they don't. And that unpredictability is disorienting for me because I don't live that way. I live with structure. I function with patterns. It's so bad that if I have laundry that is not done, I feel somewhere in my head there's a clog somewhere. Everything has to be, now I'm leaving the dishes be. Like, I see the dishes, I look at them, and I just walk right past them. Okay, yeah, I'm learning. I'm learning that it doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to be done. Mm. And I'm learning to release control. and to give myself some grace. To give myself some grace. Mm-hmm. I can't say I'm killing it.
Who is?
I can't. But
we're all
but,
just
know,
surviving.
We're just surviving. But things get familiar. Mm-hmm. Things get more familiar. And productivity-wise, well, my brain is still very much active. And I've had some really creative, strategic thoughts in the middle of the night while I'm nursing or rocking my baby, mm-hmm. you know. And it still feels like, okay, I'm still getting to use some part of me that is really important to me. Mm-hmm. Although there's that brain fog that comes.
Funny because
well, you forget a lot of things.
Yeah, I'll just say that before this episode started, we were talking about just the mom brain. And then Vera was
exactly, the mom brain.
Yeah, Vera was like, real. I don't know how I'm going to answer these questions with my mom brain. And I'm like, I don't know how I'm going to give this interview with my mom brain.
The mom but, brain is so real.
Yeah,
it's
the
so,
mom
so
brain
real.
Is very real. Yeah.
But I think we just need to measure productivity differently. Mm-hmm. We need to simmer down mm-hmm. and be nice mm-hmm. to ourselves. Because mm-hmm. even if it's not going on a spreadsheet, even if it's not like in a big boardroom, it's also just as valuable. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying, really, really learning to adapt into this new phase mm-hmm. of life. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like you're living my life. Everything you said, I can relate to it. And especially the part where babies, there's no blueprint.
No.
At all, you know?
No, you think you have them figured out this moment and then, no, oh, I think he likes this. Yeah. Oh, I can do it this way. And then tomorrow you try that same.
Yeah. And with every age that they hit, every like monthly age or even every
it
week,
unravels.
There's just different thing that they're doing, you know? Like,
completely.
If you're an organized person, have a child. They'll disorganize your life. But like you said, there's also the beauty in it too.
Oh, it's
you know,
beautiful.
It's not all it's horrible. Beautiful. It's not all bad.
It's beautiful.
I would even say that being a mother is the most fulfilling thing that I've ever had to do in my whole entire life, you know? Mm. So it's enjoyable, but it's just different. I'll just say it's
oh,
different.
The milestones. Yeah. When the milestones start to different. Come and then you say, oh my goodness, now he can grab onto stuff. Oh, he's trying to stand. You light up in ways that... It's like I said, you have to live it to fully understand. And I'm so, so grateful that we're having this conversation at this time because we're both living through it.
Yes, we are.
So it's just so relational and transformational at the same time because you feel like, oh, how am I going to survive the next 1 minute? And then there's a tiny little smile and you have all the fuel you need and you're going for another 6 hours. Okay. Yeah. We still have all of that mom emotion, so let's not break the water. I was the tough girl. Mm-hmm. I don't cry. I don't cry. You know,
I was
that girl.
Like, Anna, I probably cried more during this period of time than in my life.
Exactly. In my entire life, I haven't cried as much as I have in the past 1 year plus.
Same.
From pregnancy up until now, it's been... cartoon waterworks, like the type that almost fills up a cup, you know, because I'm happy, I want to cry, I'm sad, I want to cry. Sometimes I just want to cry for no reason.
I know.
What's wrong with you?
It's the hormones. Don't worry. It's not you. It's the hormones.
So let's just back away slowly. So we don't let stuff happen.
Yeah, because we could talk about motherhood all day, I'm sure. But let's kind of get back into, you know, your life and even let's say pre-motherhood, right? So the gap between you finishing your PhD and then having a child. You did work during that period, right? But before you took a maternity leave. So maybe if you want to kind of talk about your transition out of your PhD into the work that you're currently doing.
I actually started working as a part-time consultant while I was still completing my PhD. Mm. Yeah, because I had a plan. I didn't want to wait till the very end. It was some kind of balancing act for me. I needed to stay focused, of course, on graduating, but I also was keen on getting my foot in the industry door, because I decided early that I wasn't going to pursue academia. Because I thought about it, and honestly, what are the odds, right? Yeah. So around the third year of my program, once I'd completed most of my data generation, I began drafting my manuscripts, hoping that I would complete my thesis in late 2022. Well, that didn't happen. As always, it never happens when you plan it to. But anyways, I started putting out job applications, right? At about the same time, because I'd always seen myself in the industry as a visible minority. That path into academia, especially for tenure-tracked roles, could be an uphill climb with limited opportunities. So I just decided, you know, consulting seems like the space for me, where I could grow, where I could make the kind of impact that I want to make with all of the skills that I'm getting in the laboratory and, like, translate it into real-life solutions. So yeah, things didn't go smoothly at first. I sent out a bunch of applications. I received several no's, and many of them just ghosted me. I didn't hear back. But eventually I decided, okay, I'm gonna just pause my job hunt, finish this degree, and then pick it back up. And then in 2023, you know, because I've been searching since like late 2021. And then in 2023, when I decided, you know what, I'm just going to finish this and then pick it back up, I got an email from ARM. And it was the perfect fit, because they were offering me like a part-time role, because I needed to finish my PhD. And it was just perfect. It's exactly what I wanted. So I did that part-time role 3 times a week, and then Thursdays, Fridays. Excuse me, please. Thursdays, Fridays, I was writing my thesis. But it wasn't just Thursdays, Fridays. It was Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays, Sundays, around the clock, like trying to finish my PhD. So it all worked out fine, because at the same time, I was also relocating from Montreal to join my husband. And the role was remote. So it was just perfect. Like, it aligned with everything that I needed to do. And I started as a part-time consultant scientist with ERM. So yeah, I'd been looking since before I was even sure I was finishing my PhD.
That's really good. So what do you do exactly as a consultant scientist?
So majority of the stuff that I do with ERM is interesting, because now I get to actually use all of that knowledge that we got back in grad school, you know, the multivariate analysis, the statistical knowledge, some of all that fancy analysis that I used to do back then that I thought, oh, was just a waste. You know, now you come to an industry where not so much of that is done, because it's pretty much like the basic stuff, just tell the story to the stakeholders. But then you're able to do a few fancy graphs, colorful stuff that is nicer than your basic bar plots. Everyone is like intrigued to see that result, right? So it's really cool to bring all of that knowledge now into consulting. What we basically do is we have stakeholders, we have clients, some of them NGOs, some of them governmental parastatal, where you really basically are just looking at water quality across the country. Mm-hmm. So for now, I work majorly in lakes within Alberta, British Columbia. And then we're looking at water quality parameters in these lakes, also sediment in these lakes. And then we're just trying to understand how human influences and activities are like impacting this biodiversity that we have. And some of the interesting things that I've done, or interesting projects that I've done, since I joined ERM, before my maternity leave, of course, was the mine project, right? Because during my PhD, I didn't do a lot of mining projects. I did a lot of aquatic work on lakes, on fresh water. But here, we're actually looking at mining projects, and then you are giving, based on your data, based on your research, people are deciding if, okay, we want to shut down this mine operation or not. You know, that's like huge. And it gives a lot of voice to what you spent so many years learning to do. And then you come out and you see that, yeah, this is actually solving real-time problems. And it's bringing solutions, it's influencing policy. And that's exactly what I wanted to do from the beginning.
Wow. So that's very, very interesting. And I love how, first of all, it came at the perfect time and it was the perfect job
It
for you. And it really aligned
did.
with kind of your research interest as well,
Yes,
right? Because
100%.
I know that, and I think I've spoken about this before, about how sometimes the research that you do in your PhD or your master's may not be identical to maybe the job that you end up getting afterwards, especially if it's an industry. If it's in academia, yes, you can probably find similar research groups that you could, that align with your research interests. But one thing that I always say is the skills that you gain is what's valuable in industry, right? So when it comes to, I guess, skills that you gain, yes, your job does relate to the research that you did in your PhD, but if we talk about skills, what are some skills that you see or that you have seen in your career that you picked up from your PhD?
Oh yeah, I've got skills that transferred beautifully from my PhD into my role as a consultant. And one thing that set me apart, like really early when I got this job, was my ability to code using R. That opened a lot of doors for me. Like the moment I got in, everyone wanted me on projects because, oh, she can use R, she can code, and she knows genomics. So there was, I think, only just one genomic person in the whole aquatic team, and that was like a boss. So I'm like coming in, and I could do a lot of heavy lifting, as an entry level person. So I was quickly pulled into genomics related projects. I was entrusted with large data sets. I was given stuff to do because of that skill that I brought from my PhD from the academia, which is like coding and knowing how to work in the R space. And another thing was also not just knowing how to code and doing the analysis, it's like interpreting and visualizing the big data, because the client doesn't care about your code. The client wants to see, something that's interpretable, that's relatable. So yeah, being able to interpret, to visualize all of that big data, to be able to discuss those significant findings, all of that was like really invaluable when it came to writing reports for stakeholders, for clients in ERM.
Okay. Yeah, no, that's very interesting. So you've also recently launched an initiative called She Thrives PhD STP. Could you share a little bit about that? Because I think that it's so important what you're doing. So I just want to share with the audience what it's about.
Okay, so STP is like I don't know, what were I it's my baby before my baby. I conceived STP when I was 7 months pregnant. Fine, it's always been in my mind, but I decided to go forward and do something about it. I was heavily pregnant, 7 months, and I defended my PhD, I think, that same month. But I just decided, yeah, I'm going to do this. And that was July 2024. When I started my PhD, I went in blind. I was always the fish out of the water. Like, no one looked like me. No one talked like me in my lab, in the department, or even across the broader research network. I was always the only one. And that kind of hits differently when you're far, far, far away from home. We talked about this earlier today, without, any kind of support system. My Canadian lab mates were great, but they couldn't relate to my struggle. They really couldn't relate to the kind of struggle I had, cultural, socioeconomic, stuff that was deeply tied to identity. I wrestled with imposter syndrome. I wrestled with isolation. And to be honest, the International Student Office, the ISO, as they call it in Montreal, it couldn't help me either, because they just couldn't really relate to the complexities, the uniqueness of my journey. I battled most of these demons by myself, on my own. That's why I say I went in blind. So for years, I thought about that, and I thought about doing something about it. But of course, I kept pushing it off because PhD was literally my entire life, right? One thing I didn't do was decentralize myself from my PhD. And honestly, that's one thing I wish I would go back to do if I were going to do it again, would be to decentralize my life from my PhD.
Yeah.
And, you know, have like an identity outside of that, mm-hmm. not just sleep in the lab 24/7. So, you know, I kept pushing it off until the very end. And then I started the same month that I defended my PhD. And it's growing. It's a budding community, right? But it's been meeting needs. Like just yesterday, I was in a meeting with someone and she's facing challenges that I'm just so familiar with. And I heard that talk and it felt like listening to myself through someone else's mouth. And I'm like, yes. Because in the few months that I've been doing this, you know, sometimes not everybody who RSVP shows up for a meeting and you're thinking, oh my goodness, am I wasting my time? Or am I even committing to this? I'm in maternity leave. I should just be resting. And why am I looking for extra work for myself? But, you know,
I'm
talking to this person. Yeah, I'm talking to this person yesterday. And it just brings us all back to like, yes, this is why I decided to start this. Because STP is more than just a network. Over time, what I want to create is a movement. And the goal is to give women a sense of home, a safe place where they can bring their full selves, where they can discuss anything and find honest solutions, a place to thrive and not just survive while you're also getting an education. So what I'm trying to build is what I wish existed for me at the time I needed it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have that, but I'm hoping to build that now. And I'm hoping that it will touch as much lives as it can. And we're just getting started, you know,
mm-hmm.
Learning from every tribe webinar. I'm learning what to do next and trying out new stuff. And it's been exciting.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, what you're doing is absolutely amazing. It's quite incredible to see even the fact that you're on maternity leave and you're, like you said, still looking for work. But it's incredible to see that, you know, the experiences and everything that you went through, because you went through a lot through your PhD and even just coming here. It's great to see you pay it forward, you know, so that people don't have to struggle just the way that you did, or even if they are going through the same situation, they have support.
Because like they have support.
Yeah, like you said, it's something that you wish that you had. And I think that that's just so important for people that are going through something to pay it forward. You know, I always say that if I struggled, why do the people behind me have to struggle? I went through it for a reason. So if there's any way that I can help to make your struggle less, to comfort you, to support you, you know, I'm going to do that. So I love that you're doing that. So if someone wants to get involved with STP, either in Canada or internationally, how can they reach you or join?
Oh, yeah. So we're very present on LinkedIn. Like I've been using that tool a lot. There's a dedicated space for STP on LinkedIn. And also my personal page on LinkedIn is talking a lot about it. I'm right now in the trenches of building the website for STP. So once we have that out also, that's a place to connect. But yeah, just a quick LinkedIn search and you'll find us. And emails, yes.
Okay.
If you want me to do a quick plug, I could say what the email address is.
Go for it.
Please, she thrives PhD at Gmail, just the way it sounds. She thrives PhD at gmail.com.
Awesome. And, I'll also be right in there. The show notes too.
Yeah. I'll be right there. So if you need support, guidance, or you just want to be seen, you just need someone to listen, we're here. And that's what we do.
Awesome. I love that. And you're doing great work.
Thank you. Great. Thank you. And you owe me one.
I do. And I will deliver. I won't leave you on red like last time.
Okay. Great.
So we are getting to the end of our conversation. It was such a lovely conversation. I think that you're one of the people, I'm so glad you reached out to me, because you're one of the people where you know, we talk and we can just relate on so many levels.
So many.
Whether it be through our past, our present, you know, the things that we're doing. I love the cup, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
Another shameless
plug. You see, when you come on, when you come on a webinar and do a talk, I'll send you one.
Yeah. I love that. Thank you. But yeah, you're someone who I really, that I really click with, right? Just because of some of the things that we've been through and what we're currently doing. So thank you again for being here and for sharing your powerful story.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
No problem. Yeah. And before you leave, one thing that I always ask our guests is, because the podcast name is Lessons from a PhD, I always like to leave with a lesson, right? So through all of your experiences, everything that you've been through, if you could speak directly to someone who's listening today, whether it be an international student, a woman, someone doing their PhD, what would you say to kind of, you know, comfort them or to kind of just wrap up everything that you've been through in a lesson that you've learned?
Anna, you know, every time I've spiraled, every time I was mentally burned out in my PhD, I'd hoped someone would say stuff like this to me. You know, I'd have loved to hear someone say that. I see you. I know what you feel. It's valid. Because I've felt it too. I've been there. You know, it's like this dark cloud hovering over your head right now. It's got a date that it expires. And that expiry date is the day you defend this amazing body of work you're creating. But again, the truth is, that day would never come if you let that cloud bury you. It overs, it's there. But if you let that cloud bury you, then that day will never come. So what do? You push through the dark. How do you push through? You show up every single day. You're tired, you show up. You're unsure, you show up. You're afraid, you show up. You don't know what you're doing, you're still showing up. And then you would cross that finish line. Oh, was it easy? Will it be easy? Absolutely not. But will it be worth it? Without a doubt, you called me Dr. Vera Anana Adebona. Yeah, it has a ring to it. You know, so without a doubt, it's going to be worth it. You cannot afford to lose sight of why you started this journey. The why is essential. So you need to hold on to that why like a lifeline. Hold on to that why like a lifeline. Because even in the hardest, hardest moment, you're not alone and you matter. That PhD, that research, that work you think no one is seeing, that work you think no one is going to read. Today I'm using skills from my PhD in the industry. Your work matters and your voice matters. That's what I'd say to her. Don't let that cloud bury you.
Wow. Absolutely inspired. I'm inspired. Thank you. No, honestly, thank you so much for sharing all about your story, for sharing with our audience, being so transparent and candid about the things that you went through, the struggles that you went through, how you overcame, where you are now, what you're doing, the fantastic things that you're doing. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. You know, these conversations need to be had.
They do.
Because people need to know they're not alone. And it's such a delight to be able to come on here with a platform and just be able to say all those things. Even if it's one person, you know.
Yeah.
That's all that matters. Sure. So thank you for creating this.
Of course.
And for bringing me on. I appreciate it. I've had such an amazing time having this conversation.
And again, if you guys are interested in being part of She Thrives PhD, you can find her on LinkedIn. And I'll also include the link in the show notes and get connected. Like I always say, we need community. We need people by our side. No one ever made it to the top alone. So whatever community it is, join it and just connect with people.
Connect.
Power.
Connect.
There's power in community.
There is.
All right. Well, amazing episode. We'll wrap this up.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you so much, Anna. Thank you.